I wasn't participating in the protests necessarily, but I was documenting them, and you know, journalists were being targeted. So, as my good friend Hossam al-Hamalawi, the Egyptian blogger, always says, you know, as a journalist in times of dictatorship, you are by default an activist. So I guess I was therefore kind of participating in part of the revolution and the process. I really appreciate your opening statements there, and you know, I couldn't agree more that we definitely need to focus more on our own communities and what's happening here, whether that be in Australia, the United States. And I'm hoping, as a result of this conference, we can kind of figure out how to tie struggles, connect struggles, and learn from each other, and you know, figure out how to move forward together. But yeah, I want to thank you all for you know, inviting me and hosting me here in Sydney. It's great to be here to meet all these great journalists, activists, and others. I thank Green Left Weekly and Resistance for giving me the opportunity. We're living in an increasingly globalized world, and nothing happens in isolation from anything else these days. And I'm happy to be here in Australia to hear stories of struggle happening here and connect, you know, our various struggles and figure out how we can work together and learn from each other. As Mel was saying, it's an incredible, 2011 is an incredible year already. I think we should all, you know, take a moment. I know I haven't even done this really yet, but take a moment and realize how important the events that have already happened this year really are. And, you know, appreciate the fact that we're part of this. We're witnessing it and we're part of it, you know, as activists and journalists and others. I often think back, you know, with what's happened in Tunisia and Egypt, I think back to the Iranian Revolution of 1979 and the massive impact that those events had on the Middle East and on the entire world, really. You know, it's pretty incredible, as I said, that we're witnessing something similar. I don't mean to compare the two, but, you know, in terms of scale, what's happening now could be even greater than those events in 1979. What's different from the 1970s, maybe the 60s, is that the ability to share and spread information has changed. For journalists and activists, I think this is an important asset that we can't, you know, that we can't afford to neglect. And something common among dictatorships in the Arab world, for instance, in so-called democracies in the West and elsewhere, is the lack of accurate information available to most people through the mainstream media. Whether those media are controlled by the state directly or whether they're controlled by corporations or others in the private sector, I think both have a similar goal in maintaining the status quo and hiding the truth from most people, especially when that truth is going to expose those in power. To challenge that domination is a form of resistance. It's a form of resistance against those attempts to keep us ignorant and misinformed. And like my colleagues here, who I'm very proud to share the stage with, you know, Anthony's covering Palestine, apartheid Israel, and, you know, the complicity of the Australian government in the crimes happening there, and Kate, who's been doing excellent work on Bradley Manning and WikiLeaks and so on, you know, these are the kinds of issues we're not going to see covered regularly in the mainstream media. And I commend the tireless efforts of journalists like these two and others who, you know, are dedicated and resist these attempts to, you know, or these who make these important stories known to people, make sure they're being heard. In a time when there's so much war and injustice around the world, and while our governments continue to take away our rights, resistance in its different forms is defense of those rights is absolutely necessary. And that said, I'm honored to be here as a journalist committed to those principles of resistance, and I thank you again for having me. I've been invited to talk today about the Egyptian Revolution, which I need to do in the present tense and not the past tense. I often make that mistake, and my hand, I think, is still red from my friend in Egyptian smacking me every time I referred to it in the past, because events are still happening there, and it is still a revolution. And it's important to follow those events as they happen. This is the first time since I've left Egypt. I've been there for most of, you know, the past couple months since late January. And it's the first time I've written or, tried to write or tried to speak about things that have happened. And it's really hard to do that, as I said, because things are still happening, not only in Egypt, but in Libya and Syria, Bahrain, Yemen, and elsewhere. So the protests in Egypt were front page news around the world, as I'm sure they were here in Australia. you know, suddenly Egypt became more than a country of deserts, camels, pyramids, and became a nation of people engaged in an admirable struggle for, you know, against the tyrant. However, unlike most media, you know, would lead you to believe, the battle for Egypt didn't begin on January 25th. Hosni Mubarak didn't become an oppressive dictator only on that date. In fact, he had been one for nearly 30 years before that, and it was long before January 25th, and when those protests began, that Egyptians were engaged in a struggle for freedom and for their rights. For anyone who had been to Egypt and talked to Egyptians, they would know about their frustrations with the government. You know, it's not really hard. You can go talk to a shop owner, a taxi driver, and probably one of the few things that he knows in English, or he would have known in English, is, "I hate Hosni Mubarak." And, you know, since not everyone can board a plane and go to Egypt, this is where the job of foreign correspondents and foreign journalists comes into play. We have the responsibility to educate people outside of Egypt what's happening inside the country. For various reasons, you know, I don't think foreign journalists, generally speaking, have been doing a very good job, not only in Egypt, but elsewhere, over the years, at really putting things into perspective there. Maybe their editors sent them to cover the pyramids, but maybe they sent them to cover tourism and the pyramids. Maybe they went to Egypt and were spending time with the English-speaking circles and not really venturing outside of them. Or maybe they interviewed politicians and didn't bother to question, you know, the government's line on things. I've met many journalists like this. But I've also met many journalists who do a good job and do understand Egypt. They speak the language, they know the culture well, and they've been working there for a long time. And a problem with these journalists, a lot of them are independent, is that they have trouble finding a publication that would allow for them to call a dictator before that became fashionable earlier this year. You know, but the inaccurate coverage in much of the mainstream media allowed Mubarak, a dictator who relied greatly on financial and diplomatic support from foreign nations, to continue his brutal reign over the country and oppress his people, until finally they said enough is enough and overthrew him, which happened earlier this year. The uprisings began on January 25th, when tens of thousands ran through the streets chanting against the regime. That was unprecedented in Egypt in recent decades. Watching those scenes, I was in Beirut at the time on the 25th, and watching those scenes, you know, me and others who I was with, we knew that, okay, this is the beginning of something much bigger in Egypt. While the 25th of January was really the beginning, the 28th was, you know, the true test, when hundreds of thousands, if not millions, were expected to take to the streets across the country. And that happened after the Friday prayers on January 28th. In preparation, the government, to try to stop these, the government terrorized people by shutting down all communications. They shut down mobile phone networks, internet, and so on. But by that point, it was really already too late. I arrived that morning on the 28th, and I accompanied a group of activist friends of mine to an area of Egypt called, an area of Cairo called Imbaba. It's a working class, densely populated area. My friends wanted to make sure that the trained activists were getting out to other areas and not just in the usual, you know, central Cairo locations like Tahrir Square and elsewhere, to make sure that people had support if they needed it in different areas. You know, no one was really sure what was going to happen. They couldn't communicate with each other. They just kind of planned to go there and hope that the protests would, nothing was organized. They just hoped that the protests would kind of happen and they would be there to support people if necessary. We waited outside the mosque. There was a heavy security presence. After the Friday prayers ended, no one really was gathering. My friends and I, we were a bit, you know, worried that we were left out on the street and that the security forces and the intelligence there would try to come after us. So we hopped in a taxi to try to leave that area and head towards central Cairo, where the protests were happening. You know, we couldn't contact anyone. All the communications were down. We asked the taxi driver what's going on, if he had heard anything. He told us, you know, protests are erupting all over the city. It's crazy. We're like, okay, where are they at, you know, because they're not happening around us. But so we drove in the cab a little bit, and police were going crazy. I mean, they were shutting down. They were dragging barriers into the roads. They were trying to shut down all, like, main streets to prevent, you know, people from moving through, from different areas to different areas. So we had to go down a side street. And when we went down that side street, we noticed a small traffic jam. And I looked up, I stuck my head out the back window and looked ahead of us, and there was, like, a group of 25 people or so, and, you know, we could see them, or we could hear them chanting, and we saw a few signs being carried. So we were like, this is it, we got to hop out here, we got to see what's going on, this could be something. And we did, and we hopped out, and it was about 25 people, as I said. About half of them were children under the age of 16. Half of them were about children, like I said, and there was no organization. It was completely spontaneous. And this had just erupted in the middle of this of the street. So we joined them. My friends joined the protesters. I began taking photographs. You know, and at first, people, the chants were mixed. People were chanting, like the 25 or so, the group that started, that we joined, were chanting for people to Inzel or to come down, because, you know, there were a lot of people looking on from their balconies and from their windows, and they were chanting for people to join them in the streets. And they were also, it was also mixed with the now kind of famous slogan, you know, Shab Yurid Iskat Nizam, the people want the downfall of the regime. After about 15 minutes running down these streets and calling on people to join them, the number turned from 25 to 50 to 100. After another 15 minutes, it was, you know, maybe a few hundred. After 45 minutes, it was literally thousands. And after an hour, you couldn't even see the end of the march. And like I said, this was completely spontaneous, completely unorganized. It was a grassroots kind of uprising, where, you know, people were releasing 30 years of pent-up frustration and anger at the Hosni Mubarak dictatorship. And they marched through the streets until they reached a point where their police were kind of declared that, okay, you're not going to get past this point. And immediately the police began firing tear gas and rubber-coated bullets at the protesters, trying to disperse them and trying to scare them into halting the protest. So these are people running away down small side streets away from the tear gas. You know, every time after they did that, every time after the people would run in the opposite direction, they would always come back. And people like this were, you know, there was a group of really hardcore, I don't even want to call them activists, just people, because they were up there at the front, not undeterred by the tear gas, and, you know, would keep calling on people to come up. And the people would regroup eventually and, you know, march toward the front lines. Their ultimate goal was to reach Tahrir Square, but first they had to go through the police. And this kind of went on for hours. This is a woman from the neighborhood. She's crying because of the tear gas. Like, they were tear gassing everyone and everything. People were running out of their homes because the fumes were entering inside, and, you know, there were babies and small children all over the place, and, you know, you couldn't escape it. But here's, you know, like a woman, she's taking pictures while getting tear gassed, or taking video, I'm not sure, from her mobile phone. A lot of the media in the West and the U.S. have, you know, really tried to control the narrative of the Egyptian Revolution and portray it as, you know, something that was entirely peaceful, which is completely false, and a lot of Egyptians will reject this. When people took to the streets, they faced brutal repression, and they fought back. You know, people were armed themselves with whatever they could. A lot of people took stones from the street, broke stones and threw them back at the police. You know, this group of youth went up on top of a building. The police are down below in the background. You can see they're armed with stones, and they were battling the police. They were throwing stones against them. This happened all over the country, not only in Cairo, not only in Mbaba, but everywhere where there was an uprising, which was the entire country essentially, people battled the police. Later that day, they defeated the police. They chased the police off the streets, literally. And, you know, everyone made their way in Cairo, everyone made their way to Tahrir Square, even though the police had tried to prevent them. And this day was kind of the beginning of the major sit-in. Egyptians aren't used to street protests, and certainly not kind of, you know, resisting police violence. But that just shows you this was something completely new, you know, in Egypt, these kinds of street protests and battles with authorities. And people sustained injuries. This guy, I'm not sure if he was hit with a tear gas canister or a rubber-coated steel bullet, U.S.-made weaponry, by the way. But he was injured, and this was quite common. They weren't using live ammunition in the area where I was. And in Cairo in general, they tried to avoid using live ammunition, I think, but certainly elsewhere in places like Suez and Alexandria, I mean, there were heavy casualties during the whole uprising. Close to 1,000 people were killed, as the numbers were just recently released. Again, more signs of the peaceful Egyptian protests. And I don't mean to be condemning the use of violence or whatever you want to call it, but it's just inaccurate to portray them as such. I mean, Egyptians on the 28th, on that day, they took over Hosni Mubarak's, his party's headquarters, which this is, the National Democratic Party, which has become since a symbol of kind of the uprising and of the revolution, and they burned it to a crisp. This was taken the next day, the morning, and it's still in flames. You can still, if you go to Cairo today, the building's still standing, and it's still all burnt out like that. I think they're going to tear it down soon, though. But it's become like the symbol of the revolution in Cairo, the burnt out NDP building. Everyone's seen the pictures from Tahrir Square. I'm not going to show too many of them. But, you know, like I said, in Imbaba and elsewhere in Cairo, when the people protested, their ultimate goal was to reach Tahrir Square. And, you know, because they fought the police for a number of hours, they defeated the police, they opened the ways to get there, and that's where they all joined together. Throughout the 3 weeks or 2 weeks of the protest after that, and even since then, as protests continue, a lot of people have come up to me, because I was the lone foreigner and the lone journalist in that Imbaba area, and they recognize me from Imbaba, and they all come up to say hello. I mean, and, it's quite nice. But here's the symbol of Tahrir Square, where all kinds of people gathered here. A young woman, a young girl is taking pictures from her mobile phone. This was what's been called Bloody Wednesday, when thugs of the regime tried to attack the demonstration at Tahrir Square, and, you know, there were no police on the streets. By that point, there was the army, which people were doing their best to chant, you know, Geish Shab Eid Wahda, the army and the people are one hand, or are one. The army clearly, I think, had taken a side in that it didn't do anything to prevent, like, a day like this when it was when one peaceful protesters, and they were peaceful in Tahrir Square, were attacked. The army didn't do anything to stop those attackers. And it was quite frightening, actually, and people, a lot of people were fearing that, that there was going to be a massacre or something, you know, heavy casualties. At first, they were almost outnumbered. The people in Tahrir were almost outnumbered by the thugs and the other people who were, you know, paid off by the regime in many cases to attack the square. But throughout the day and throughout the next day as well, a lot of people joined from elsewhere in the city. They came to join Tahrir Square and fight back against those attacking thugs. And they threw stones, and it was kind of a battle of stones, which I and many others were actually injured in. But it was just stones going back and forth like this, and eventually the people of Tahrir Square forced the thugs and others to retreat. During that night, there was four casualties. Four people were killed by a sniper, which maybe you've seen on Al Jazeera and replayed elsewhere. There's been footage of it where the sniper has taken aim and killed four people, four unarmed protesters atop a bridge. As I said, there was almost 1,000 people killed during those few weeks. Here's pictures of some of those killed, and a woman leading kind of chants or prayers to remember those who had been killed fighting the regime. And the protests continued throughout the night. They didn't stop. At points, they varied in kind of energy and size, but, you know, always there was a hardcore group of people at Tahrir who were committed and were there, stayed there, and, you know, there were tens of thousands. They stayed there day and night, and they continued the protest even throughout the night. That's an effigy of Mubarak hanging from the lamppost and a guy holding his shoe up to it. This was on the night before, so February 10th. People thought, that's it, like, he's got to go. I mean, these protests were going on forever, and people had kind of controlled themselves, and they didn't want to have to escalate things. They hadn't, after the 28th, they hadn't gone after, like, the state TV building or the presidential palace. They had stayed at Tahrir, hoping that Mubarak would leave on his own if they continued to stay at Tahrir, and called for his ouster. This was on that night right before he left, where people were gathered in Tahrir watching the TV. I think it was his third speech, Mubarak's third speech since the uprising began, where he again said that he wasn't going to be stepping down. Just a quick note, this guy on the right is from Ismailia. He's from a town outside Cairo. He was a political prisoner for 25 years, imprisoned under the Sadat regime. And to his left is, you know, these people probably wouldn't have come together, but I talked to him on the guy on his left. He was a 21-year-old secular. The guy on the right identifies it as an Islamist, but on his left is a secular 21-year-old activist, essentially. He became an activist on the 25th. He's a working-class kid who's concerned about his future and going to be graduating soon, and came out on the 25th and stayed at Tahrir every minute after that. So Mubarak didn't resign, and this next picture is what we'll see the next day. And that was Friday, the famous, now famous, February 11th, when millions... Tahrir Square is huge. I don't know if anyone's seen it, but it's a massive area. And it was completely packed. I mean, it took you, like, to get through the crowds, it took you almost, like, 2 hours just to walk through. So this was, like, the Friday prayer. And as soon as that ended, people broke out into protest. And there was just such an energy coming out of Tahrir. I can't even describe it. But it was just such an energy, such a noise, such a feeling. Like, even now looking at this picture, it's giving me chills. And you knew, like, no way could Mubarak, you know, last after that day. And yeah, he didn't. I mean, people marched to the presidential palace. They marched to the state TV building, which Mubarak had been using to spread propaganda. And there was almost confrontations between the army and the police. And, you know, later that afternoon is when the appointed vice president, Omar Suleiman got on TV and announced that Mubarak would be leaving. And then what happened next? The celebrations at Tahrir. And it was a joyous, festive occasion. It was quite beautiful to be there after those few weeks of, you know, struggle. And the next day was the birth of the new Egypt. A lot of people did, you know, people were very proud. One of the chants was, you know, lift your head up high, you're an Egyptian. A lot of people were very proud by the fact that they had, you know, taken democracy into their own hands, that they had overthrown their dictator, and they did it all on their own. The joke about the name, but some people have heard of stories, you know, naming their children Facebook and other, happened once or twice, and other revolution-related names. But yeah, people are, there's a sense of pride in Egypt that exists, that didn't exist before, and it's quite amazing to be there and to have witnessed that and to talk to people. And I think it's important, as I said, the revolution is still ongoing. People are still very committed to the struggle and making sure that democracy becomes realized in Egypt. And I think, you know, now more than ever, I think our solidarity and our connections with Egypt and with the movement there need to be strengthened, and we need to follow closely what's happening with not only in Egypt but elsewhere across the Middle East.